Welcome to the History Slam podcast from ActiveHistory.ca. Here is your host, Sean Graham.
And thank you, Adam, and welcome to the History Slam, everybody. I am Sean Graham, coming at you today nearly live. We are in Ottawa, Ontario, back on the University of Ottawa campus for the final day of Northern History Week here at ActiveHistory.ca. It's been a lot of fun to interview all the different artists, and I think some of the written pieces, or all the written pieces that we've had as part of the week, have been fantastic. And is there a better way to cap it off than having Madeline Klosky on the podcast? I don't think there is. Welcome to the podcast, Madeline.
Thank you for having me.
So we just went and saw a screening of a film called Degrees North, and it was preceded by three short films. And we'll go through each of the films and talk about what we thought about them, about this evening, which was held over at the Mercury Lounge in the Byward Market here in Ottawa. It's part of Northern Scene at the National Arts Centre. Now, first of all, what did you think of the venue?
I thought it was a unique venue to hold a film screening. I think towards the end, some of the late night crowd might have been awaiting our departure.
Yeah.
But that being said, I think it was interesting in that despite it, the fact that it was a different venue, it was a packed house, which says a lot for the draw of these films.
Yeah, for sure. And I'm sure that being part of the festival was part of it, but it, you know, full house, and I think we really lucked out sitting up on the balcony part, because it was probably like 10 degrees cooler up there.
It was. I was surprised, actually, so we're very lucky.
Yeah. So we'll go through the films in the order in which they were presented. And the first one was called Come Back, Little Star by Andrew Connors, and it's a 3-minute short film, and Andrew Connors, it says here, is the artistic director of the Yukon Film Society and the festival director of the Available Light Film Festival. So the film basically is a voiceover of a mother talking to her son.
Yes, sort of talking to her son about how she feels about his father, him growing up, and his opportunities.
And I think when it closes, it talks about how the mother doesn't want the son to follow the same life as the father.
Yeah.
Who's a minor.
Yeah, he was a minor, and she didn't want him to follow that same sort of dangerous life. That's sort of the tone that I had. And I also sort of picked up at the end, maybe incorrectly, that the son had left, and she was disappointed that he had to leave, but also realized that it was necessary for the choices that she wanted for him.
Right.
Or opportunities.
Right, but she said, she's lamenting that this is
the case. Yeah, she's lamenting that this is the case and the path that had to be followed.
Right, and you said something interesting as we walked over here about that this is an interesting commentary on Northern life in general.
It is. I think, I mean, in rural Canada in general, rural depopulation, and in particular young people having to leave these sort of rural communities, has always been a problem since the 19th centuries, and you know, always been something that people have lamented, and particularly the older generation has lamented in regards to the younger generation. And so I thought that that was a particularly poignant film in that respect.
Yeah, I agree. It made a very interesting point. I thought the part where the mother says that she went into labor early and had to be airlifted out of there. And the father drove all night to be there for the birth and then went right back to work. It was an interesting, in setting up that the mother didn't want the son to follow the same life.
Yeah, definitely that there was, I think, some hardship there. Isolation also seemed to be a very prominent feature of that film too, both with the fact that she had to be airlifted out, but just the fact that family members themselves are so far apart from each other.
For sure, for sure. So the next film that we saw was by Lulu Keating, called Dawson Town Melted Down. This was 6 minutes, and it basically explained why she moved to Dawson City. She's not from Dawson City, but she moved to Dawson City, and the film sort of tries to explain why. And it's done in a very humorous way. Now, I thought, and I think we would disagree on this, I thought it was a very positive reflection of the town, but you thought there were some, she highlighted some negative aspects as well.
I wouldn't say negative necessarily, as maybe some more quirky elements of the community. Some of the aspects of it being a smaller, more remote community. You know, when she jokes about the going shopping at the garbage pile, my favorite clip was the refrigerator Stonehenge, where somebody had made a replica Stonehenge out of old refrigerators.
Brilliant.
So again, like, not necessarily negative, but just more quirky and maybe things that people wouldn't necessarily highlight about the community they live in. But that's one of the things I appreciated most about the film.
And it was funny. Like,
it was very funny.
It's legitimately funny. And yeah, I agree with you that she does a good job of setting up the town. And and really, the point of the film is to answer the question, why did you move to Dawson? And I think she does that really well in highlighting positive and then maybe some of these quirky aspects. And basically saying it's a fun place to be.
Oh, I think she did an excellent job of pointing out and illustrating the character of the city, which is, in my opinion, one of the best places to move somewhere is a place with great character.
Yeah.
And I think it's important, too, because so many people miss out on that aspect of the North in their understanding. And that's what made that film one of my favorites out of the four, is that it really put a human face on the city.
For sure. And by one of our favorites, I think we would agree that it was our favorite.
Yes.
Of the four.
Most definitely. Yeah. One of the shortest, but definitely the best. Yeah.
Actually, the longest of the shorts, though.
Oh, really?
It was the second longest one we saw.
It was so enjoyable. It flew by.
Yeah. I think it really did fly by. It didn't feel like 6 minutes. I know that 6 minutes isn't a long time, but it didn't feel like 6 minutes.
Yeah. No, definitely.
Okay. So the third film that we watched is called Finding Milton by a guy named Daniel Jank. And this movie follows a man on a street with a blowhorn reciting a poem of Milton Acorn.
Yes, and interestingly enough, it's a busy city street, and not one that we would associate with northern Canada. It appears to be something more along the lines of Vancouver or Toronto.
Yeah.
At night, so there's lots of cars, there's sirens, there's lots of people on the street, so a lot of background noise to contend with.
Mm-hmm. And you can't... So you can't hear it because he's on a blowhorn with all this background noise. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure that the Mercury Lounge isn't wired for film. Right?
No.
Like, so it's not the greatest acoustics for the film. So that probably played a role. But I think a bigger role was the fact that it's a blowhorn with street noise.
It was very unclear. It probably took me about halfway through the 3 minutes of the film to even figure out that he was reciting a poem, because there was so much going on when it started that it's almost a little bit of an assault on your senses. So you can't quite, it takes a minute to orient yourself with what's going on.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, he wasn't there for the Q&A, which would have been nice because we could have understood what he was trying to, like, what point he was trying to make.
Exactly. Which the Q&A did help illuminate the ideas behind some of the other films. But unfortunately, we didn't have that opportunity with this one. So I'm remaining a little bit in the dark.
It was a little, maybe I'm just not smart enough to understand what it was about. But I have no idea what it was about.
No, it, it wasn't in my wheelhouse, if
yes.
you will.
Yeah. But this guy, interestingly enough, looking at his little bio here, he is the composer and director of the live stage part of Grubstake, which is touring around the country and is going to be in Ottawa tonight, if you're listening. Not tonight when we're talking, but tonight when you're listening, if you listen to this is right as soon as it's released, which you all should be doing anyway. tonight, which is Friday night at the Mayfair Theater. So, you know, and we're not trying to say that it wasn't well done. It's just we didn't really understand the purpose.
Yeah, it seemed to be in a different strain than the other three films that we saw. The other three films seemed to have a bit of a common strain, and this one was a bit different. And because of that, it was hard to see where it fit in terms of the themes that we're sort of looking at in this festival.
Mm-hmm. So we'll move on to the final film, and this was the film that was really the focal point of the evening. Mm-hmm. Because it's a feature film by Dan Sokolowski called Degrees North. And this film basically is It highlights the landscape from, what, 42 degrees up to 66 degrees, which is the southern part of the Arctic Circle.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a film which doesn't have a lot of dialogue, by which I mean there's no dialogue.
No, other than the I believe, two songs that we hear at some point, which obviously have lyrics, but even the majority of the music for this film is instrumental.
So basically, so it goes and he highlights a different area as we move up from each latitude. And so it goes from like 42 to 46 to 48 and so on and so forth. And it highlights a different part along that line. So it's not until about, and it's silent with the music in the background, which is designed to highlight that particular landscape. But it's not until about halfway through where you get this first first song with lyrics. And it was very Sarah McLachlan sounding.
It was, and I believe he paired that song choice with the Athabasca region.
Yes, he did.
And the lyrics of the song were very much based on northern topics, and this idea that I think it was talking about the northern sky and things like that. But it did seem so different from the previous musical choices, which were largely classical. He had some Bach in there, et cetera.
Yeah.
That it was a bit jarring when this song started because it was so different. And then I thought, oh, is it going to change now that we're reaching these more northern climates? Mm-hmm. Is there going to be more expressive music? And I thought that that was a deliberate choice. And I thought, well, this is so interesting. But then once we moved on to the next region, which I believe was Dawson or the Yukon area.
Yeah.
After Athabasca.
I don't think it was quite Dawson. I think there was like a...
Yeah. I think it went to the Yukon area.
I think it was like right on the 60.
But it went right back to classical music again. Yeah. So that choice of using the lyrical composition for the Athabasca region seemed out of place. And I was looking forward to perhaps them having a Q&A with the filmmaker who was present for the screening afterwards.
Yep.
And they did, in fact, have a Q&A, and someone questioned him on this musical choice. And there didn't seem to be a purpose for it, which was perplexing because it was so jarringly different from everything else.
Yeah.
But it was an interesting part of the film. And we should add, too, that in addition to the film snippets from each different region, this is also interspersed with art.
Yes.
That sort of mimics the region. So it goes back and forth between images and art. And there's also parts of the film where there's no music at all, and it's like nature sounds. Yeah. So there's a lot of birds, water, things like that.
Yeah, it struck me that I didn't understand the paint part.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't understand what it was trying to express because it seemed to me that the purpose of the film was to show the changing landscape as you move north.
Mm-hmm.
And the paint part, I didn't really understand how that fit into that purpose.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing that struck me as we were watching it is that the way it's shot, to a certain degree, if you put that on an IMAX,
mm-hmm.
it'd be a great IMAX movie.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's these wide landscape shots. Some of them are sweeping, not many, but you are very, and I use the term static in it. I don't mean it as a negative. It's static in that it's a set shot, and usually long shots. You put that on an IMAX screen with the same score even, and I think it's a very powerful film.
Mm-hmm.
But again, in that setting, it wasn't, and with the paint intermixed, I didn't understand what that was contributing to what I think the overall point of the film was.
I agree. It was an interesting choice. It was definitely an artistic choice, I think a preference. He, in the credits at the end of the film, he did some thank yous for his artistic training, I believe, from his parents.
Yes.
So it's obviously something that's important to the filmmaker.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe not directly tied into the purpose of the film, which if we sort of move on to that aspect of the film, I thought one thing it did very well was to highlight all these different regions.
Yeah.
The one thing that I thought was interesting, while we're moving from the 42nd parallel all the way up to the 66th, so from south to north, we're also sort of moving in a general east to west direction.
Yeah.
He very much sort of followed that east to west trend as he moved north. So I wonder if that was a conscious choice or just
circumstantial. Yeah, because someone asked him in the Q&A about the seasons, and at the start of the film, it's the summer.
Mm-hmm.
And then as he progresses, it turns into the winter. And someone asked him if that was a conscious choice that he made, and he said no, it just happened that way. So, and based on when he could travel,
mm-hmm.
given funding opportunities and all that, and just scheduling, logistics. So you wonder if that was a conscious choice as well, or if, well, no, I can get to this place.
Well, I did notice in the credits that the initial shots for this film began in 1997.
Yes.
And I think the most recent were 2011.
Yep.
So the shots for this film were over quite a long span of time.
Yes. But he didn't shoot them consecutively.
No.
So it wasn't like I'm going to start in the most southern point and then
yeah.
move my way up. He sort of, because it says that his first shot was in the Badlands in Alberta. The final one was in Dawson. So that's so just based on those two, it's not a chronological
shoot. No, it was.
Shoot.
It definitely seems like it was travel of opportunity.
Yeah, which he said. Like mm-hmm. He openly said that.
But that being said, I mean, you could tell some of the, you know, I'm not surprised that Alberta and the Badlands came first, because I actually thought out of all the footage that that looked the most grainy to me.
Right.
And
but
I know
he shot it all on the same
camera. He was shooting everything on the same camera. I believe there were 16 millimeter cameras, and maybe it was being less familiar with that camera or something. But that footage did strike me as being a little less clear than some of the other footage.
Uh-huh.
But that being said, despite sort of the erratic order of things, the film does a beautiful job of highlighting all these different regions and the different sort of natural settings as you move north. But that being said, the choices that he's chosen in each region are very particular.
Yeah.
Each snapshot or scene that he depicts is a very specific one and does not encompass perhaps some of the things that we know most about those regions too.
Right.
For example, going back to the Badlands again, some of the scenes he chose I didn't think were the most popular images of the Badlands. So it's sort of interesting, the scenes that he chose.
Mm-hmm. And he didn't go directly for the most visually stunning.
No, it was very subtle.
Yeah. So, and I did appreciate that it's not a stereotypical piece
mm-hmm.
of, look, we're going more north and I'm going to show this and this and this. Like, it's stuff that you don't normally see or stuff that maybe you wouldn't expect in a film about the landscape.
Mm-hmm.
So for that, I did appreciate that aspect.
And he did a good job of intertwining sort of close-up shots with more panoramic shots.
Yeah.
So you do have the panorama of the beach on the North Shore, for example, the Great Lakes. But then he would also do a close-up shot of a shell on the sand.
Yeah.
So there is that sort of intermixing as well.
Yeah. And there's not a human being in the movie.
No. There's a sounds of birds. I think we saw a bald eagle in the Yukon region. But other than that, we didn't see much wildlife. We heard a lot of wildlife. Mm. There's snippets of birds.
Yeah.
And
there's lots of, you hear water, you hear lots of waves.
Yeah.
But no people.
No, you know.
Which I don't know if that, again, you know, you'd like to talk to him a little bit deeper about it. But again, if that's, I'm sure that was a conscious choice that you don't want people in it.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's no people, but he's not presenting any sort of barren land.
Mm-hmm.
That it's a lively place without people.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an interesting message, because again, and we'll talk about this a little later, but what people conceive the North to be, and I think people conceive it as a very barren place.
Oh, I think so. And what was interesting is the couple animals we did see, there was the bald eagle, and I think there were some sheep or wild sheep or something. Those elements didn't themselves appear until we got into the far north, mm-hmm. the much more northern regions of the film. So I wonder, too, if that was a conscious choice. Because we do typically associate those regions as being more barren, at least in the popular mind.
Yeah. Yeah. So let's talk about The North generally then, because we talked about the four films. And you have taught the rural history course here at the University of Ottawa very ably, from all accounts. Very highly reviewed professor. So we were talking a little bit before, and I've written about this, that I think we have this conception of what the North is in, I'll at least speak to Southern Ontario because that's where I grew up, of the North being this very monolithic place that it's just this one place and it's all the same and all the people there are the same and they all, and the weather is the same. And it's just we see the North as just this homogenous thing. But in doing the stuff for the festival at Northern Scene that I've been able to do so far, and also the stuff that we've read already on Active History as part of Northern History Week, you can see that there's this great diversity within the region. And all you have to do is just look at the geography of it, that people in Northern Labrador are going to be different from people in the Yukon. Because people in St. John's are different from people in Victoria. I mean, it's just the way it is, that it's a huge region. And I'm wondering, with your background in rural history, well, first of all, would we consider the North part of rural Canada? And two, how would you characterize it in teaching it to your students?
Well, to answer your first question, in my course, I definitely consider the North as part of rural Canada. It shares a lot of the features of what we would consider to be rural Canada. In many cases, it's isolated. There's low population density. And much of the economy is based on resource extraction. That being said, you know, to answer your second question, unlike other areas of rural Canada, most Canadians do not have firsthand experience with Northern Canada, which is what makes festivals like Northern Scene so important. Most Canadians have their view of the North mediated by what we see in popular culture. And I think that's where we get this sort of monolithic view of the North that you're referencing. In my course, when I talk about the North, we sort of look at that idea in the historiography. And we also look at this idea that not only are we outsiders viewing the North as a hinterland, but there are also people in the North and in various parts of the North. And these are diverse peoples that call it a homeland. And so you sort of have to take people out of the perspective that they're used to and show them these different things so that they do understand that just like people in St. John's and Victoria are different, so are people in the Yukon and Northern Labrador. And I think not only the films we've seen tonight, but a lot of other elements of Northern Scene have really demonstrated this.
Yeah, and the other thing that I think people think of the North is that it's, not only is it a monolith, but it's a monolith that is static, that it's stuck in 1904, and it's never changing. I think the Lulu Keating film highlighted how that's just not true, but I think when people think of the North, they think of, like, I talked about this when we talked about Dorset Scene on Tuesday with Sandra Dick and Leslie Boyd from Carleton, that one of the artists from Cape Dorset in the 70s drew a plane that had, like, I guess he went to the airport in Dorset and drew a plane. And when they did the exhibition somewhere in southern, I think southern Ontario, they said that he was criticized because people in the south didn't think that planes had reached there yet. And I think they didn't think that that was an accurate depiction of life in Cape Dorset, that there would be a plane there. And I realize that that's 40 years ago. But I think that that ideology or that perception of the North still exists a little bit, that if you go to Whitehorse or if you go to Yellowknife or you go to Iqaluit, and forget about some of the smaller towns, if you even go to those major centers in the North, that you're going into a period back in time. And it's really remarkable to me that, because we complain that the United States about Americans, and we're like, oh, Americans think we all live in igloos. And yet in Southern Canada, a lot of people have similar stereotypes about Northern Canada.
Exactly.
And it's this weird dynamic to me that I don't know how we can reconcile that given what we've seen as part of the festival here in Ottawa, that people are doing some very innovative things. And rather than seeing the North as static and traditional, that there's a lot of innovation, and And that's not a new thing. It's always been that way. So I'm sort of wondering, you know, how do you think we may be able to change that perception the same way that rural Canadians for a long time have sort of fought to have their voice heard and show that they're a major part of the mosaic of this country?
Well, I think definitely events like Northern Scene this week help. But in general, I mean, it's a difficult task because even now, it's not the easiest thing for people to get that firsthand experience with the North. And compared to other parts of Canada, there aren't as many, let's say, available popular cultural artifacts for them to engage with. And until that happens, it's going to be very difficult for people to maybe understand. One thing I really liked during the Q&A with the films that we saw tonight was the discussion with Lulu Keating. And she talks about the music that she chose for her film and how the music she actually wrote herself with an artist who was passing through town and staying at her house. And they wrote the lyrics and the music, and it was a 3-day process. But it really gave a sense of sort of the cultural vibrancy in that community. And again, something that people don't normally associate with and or with that area. And so I think, you know, the more we hear stories like that, and, you know, especially with Lulu Keating's film, the more films that we see like that and the more available they are to people, I think the more that sort of barrier of understanding will be broken down. Mm-hmm. And that's why funding for programs like these is so important.
Yes. And they made that point during the mm-hmm. Q&A too. I said my background or growing up in Southern Ontario, you grew up on, for the most part, on Vancouver mm-hmm. Island.
Yes.
But you have Northern experience.
Somewhat. I was born in more or less Northern British Columbia in Terrace. Although I left when I was, I believe, at the wee age of 3, 3 and a half. So I don't have too many memories there other than being sort of forced into a snowsuit. And my mother was born in Whitehorse. So I've heard a lot of stories from her growing up. But yeah, the majority of my childhood and later years was spent on Vancouver Island.
So I'm wondering that, you know, that's my perception mm-hmm. of how people think of the North in Southern Ontario. Does that correspond well with your experience growing up and living on Vancouver Island?
I think that's sort of a twofold question. The first is that in general, I think that people do have the same sort of distant view of the North and this idea that it's monolithic among the general population. I think that's very similar to what you've described to me in Southern Ontario and what I encounter with my students here. Mm. A lot of people have that definite distance and understanding. But that being said, going to university in British Columbia, where I did my undergrad, we actually get a lot of students from the Yukon who come to BC to do their post-secondary education just for convenience sake. Because of that, I think there's a little bit more understanding about the Yukon, only because we have more interaction with that population in British Columbia. But that being said, I don't think that understanding, and at least it didn't for me growing up, mm-hmm. That understanding did not extend to the Northwest Territories and other northern regions of Canada.
Right.
So while I may have growing up had an understanding that there were these populations in the Yukon and they were very similar, you know, not primitive as we would say, these were modern towns. There, that understanding definitely didn't extend to other regions. So the rest of the northern region of Canada, I would have looked at as monolithic, you know, no people.
Right.
Yeah.
What about the First Nations component? Because in Southern Ontario growing up, there's not a lot of First Nations people, at least in the Greater Toronto Area. There weren't a lot of First Nations people around. And I certainly, in my mm-hmm. elementary school and high school, there were certainly no First Nations people there. Whereas on Vancouver Island, there's a bigger First Nation mm-hmm. population. And I think a lot of people associate the North with First Nations and Inuit people.
Mm-hmm.
So did that have any sort of effect on how people saw the North?
I think, again, there's a bit of a greater understanding because one of the first things I noticed when I moved to Ontario was actually the lack of First Nations population in the cities here, at least compared to what I was used to, because growing up on Vancouver Island, the communities interact with each other so much.
Yeah.
And so we do have a little bit more understanding. But that being said, growing up, you know, before I read and researched on the matter, I sort of viewed, and I know other people did too, the North as sort of being the place where Inuit lived.
Right.
And that was just sort of a common understanding and, you know, not false, but not entirely true either. So it is sort of, again, this generalization that doesn't take into consideration all the variations, all the differences, all the uniquenesses
right.
of all the people who live in the North.
Mm-hmm. One of the most interesting things that I found in doing research about the scene is that there was an artist who had moved from the New York City area.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it was in the city itself, who had moved up into Nunavut, and they had opened a gallery. And he was an African-American. And in just researching him and doing his work, or looking into his work, you wouldn't expect an African-American from New York to open an art gallery in Nunavut. And it's one of those things that, again, there's a great diversity there that you have to be aware of. And you can't just lump it in and say, this is what it is. And it's the same way that you would treat any city. Yes, there are, or any region. Like, yes, there are certain characteristics
mm-hmm.
that will define it, but within that broad framework, there's so much going on, and you really have to study it more at a micro level.
Very much so. I mean, just like anywhere else in Canada,
yeah.
You can take a snapshot of any place in Canada and find similar situations, and so it's no less true for the North, and that's something that we have to think about. And going back to the Lulu Keating film, I mean, I believe she was from Halifax. And she moved to Dawson City, and after she went there and was just completely taken in by it. And I imagine that happens for a lot of people because it is such a unique region.
Yeah. Yeah. And people who have been have talked about the power of it.
Mm-hmm.
That, when you're out in certain areas, that the landscape can be almost overwhelming. And I mean overwhelming in a good way.
Mm-hmm.
Is that you're just almost sort of stunned and mm-hmm. in awe of what it is. So, you know, I mean, and again, I think it's good that we have an opportunity here to discuss it and think about it critically, but at the same time, maybe celebrate it and use it or use the festival and hopefully what we're doing here at Active History this week or what we have done here this week, but as a way to engage people in a discussion about the North and think about it in new ways.
Mm-hmm.
Because one of the things when we started this, the first interview I did about the scene was with Heather Moore. And one of the words I think she used was that it was a very vibrant region.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is different from how most people would consider it. But again, it's, you know, that's just, by no means are we the defining word on Northern Canada.
I'm, you know, really thankful that events like this take place because it does help to mediate or at least contribute to shaping how other Canadians view that region or understand that region, because there is a sort of lack of understanding,
yeah.
probably more so than any other region of Canada.
Yeah.
And it's really important to let people know that things like this exist so that mm-hmm. they can find out for themselves.
Yeah. Like a friend of mine, and I won't say who it is because I don't want to reveal it. Cause there's a, like I said, like there's this Northern scene going on. I'm going to go to a couple shows. Do you want to go with me? And the response was like, "Why? Who cares?
Mm-hmm.
Who cares about the North?" And it made me sad that existed. That was the first reaction. It's like, "Oh, the North. Who cares?"
Mm-hmm.
It was unfortunate. So yeah, and I think the bad part about Northern scene is that it is so localized.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and I realize it's a huge festival with a lot of moving parts, and it would be impossible to hold this thing in every city around the
yeah.
country. But even a smaller version of a similar festival in various parts of the country, I think, could be useful
mm-hmm.
if it could possibly be arranged. And it would have to be arranged by someone who's much smarter and much more organized than I. But there's my idea for whoever wants to take
it. Well, you're certainly doing your part by bringing the highlights of Northern Scene to the interwebs.
Yes, as we always try to do here on the History Slam podcast. So, Madeline, talk about your own personal research. We talked about you as a professor here teaching rural Canada. give the people a little insight into what they can expect in the next couple of years coming from you.
In the next couple of years, that's a daunting time frame, Sean Graham. Well, my own personal research does not necessarily focus on rural Canada, but I will be looking at the equally interesting topic of thrift, conservation, and ideas of saving in Canada during the First World War and in the years following the First World War. It's a really interesting period, and especially as we come up on the 100-year anniversary, it's getting a lot of attention right now, so yeah. It's very interesting.
Yeah, and there's some crossover with active history contributor Ian Mosby and his stuff that he's done with cookbooks and stuff.
Yes, very interesting, yeah. Very interesting.
So it's a very, very interesting project, and we're all very excited to see what you come up with. So, Madeline Klosky, thanks for doing this. Your Twitter handle is at Mad Klosk?
At Mad Klosky, so MadKlosky.
That's a good follow. Follow Madeline. So thanks very much for doing this.
Thank you for having
me. And thanks
me.
For coming to the show, the movies.
Oh, no, it was a treat.
Oh, good, good. So Madeline Klosky from the University of Ottawa here, professor of rural history, and you can find her work on conservation and thrift in the First World War in the next couple of years. I would like to thank everybody at the website for their help with Northern History Week. And I would also like to thank everybody at the National Arts Center, Laura Denker, Marnie Richardson, Carla Wolf, and Martin down in the Hexagon Studio. All the guests this week, it's been a lot of fun. I think we've had some great conversations, and I've been thrilled with the way it's turned out. So my thanks to Tom McSorley, Leslie Boyd, Sandra Dick, Leonard Linklater, Greg Hare, Susan Moorhead Mooney, Lynn Fabio, Shirley Morehouse, John Sabrin, and Madeline Klosky. I'd also like to thank Ian Milligan, who, as always, has been extremely helpful with the podcast, and Jim Clifford, who has been instrumental with the written pieces that I'm sure everyone has been enjoying up on the site, as I have. So many thanks to Jim, and also to all the people who wrote for Northern History Week. It was a major undertaking for everybody at the site, and I think it's turned out really well, and I've been thrilled to have the opportunity to take part. So if anybody has any comments, questions for the podcast, historyslam@gmail.com. Find me on Twitter at Dr. Shawnee Fever. And if you're out and you see Enrico Palazzo, please say hi for me.
Thanks for listening to the History Slam podcast. Check out activehistory.ca for more features and articles, and be sure to subscribe on iTunes.